Still, few doubt the strength of reaction if a Western figure of General Soleimani's stature were assassinated on the orders of another nation's head of state.
It's clear that Washington has been unable to justify the killing of a man who saved the Middle East and the world from ISIL, a terror group largely created by Western military miscalculations. Though the Western public is not encouraged to know the truth, many insist these facts are shared. Yet if such an attack were carried out against a Western power, it could lead to invasion or even war. For many, this death by double standards continues to stain the reputation of the West, because the years since the murder of General Soleimani do not diminish the crime.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
When opposing the withdrawal from Afghanistan, the Seahawks crowed about human rights. With U.S. sanctions causing starvation? Not so much, says Murtaza Hussein, journalist, in an article published under the heading "The Silence or Worse of Human Rights Hawks on U.S. Sanctions Against Afghanistan." Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Month after the U.S.-backed Afghan government fell to the Taliban, ordinary Afghans now face what could be their direst winter in decades. Thanks to the economic collapse that accompanied the U.S. military withdrawal, coupled with the imposition of sanctions and the cessation of much humanitarian aid, millions of Afghans must contend with the very real prospect of starvation. Some will die. Many will lose their lives to preventable death. While limited humanitarian exceptions for trade have been carved out in recent weeks, the World Health Organization has already warned that up to 1 million Afghan children may die as a result of malnutrition over this winter if drastic steps are not taken. Children are already bearing the brunt of the humanitarian catastrophe, punctuated by horrifying stories of kids being sold to pay for food. And the country's notoriously harsh winter is already taking a toll. Afghans are freezing to death as they flee the country with their families. U.S. sanctions policy is directly to blame, pushing Afghans over the edge as they already struggle to deal with the COVID-19 pandemic and the political upheaval created by the collapse of the central government, as Paul Spiegel, director of the Center for Humanitarian Health at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, wrote last December after returning from a trip to Afghanistan on behalf of the WHO. "I can clearly state that if the United States and other Western governments do not change their Afghanistan sanction policies, more Afghans will die from sanctions than at the hands of the Taliban. The deaths will be brought about as a result of deliberate policy decisions made in the U.S. Alongside new sanctions imposed after the Taliban takeover, the U.S. froze nearly $10 billion of Afghanistan's central bank holdings there. The Biden administration refuses to release the funds despite ongoing public protests by Afghans. As all of this plays out, the clamor of voices criticizing the U.S. military withdrawal this summer on humanitarian grounds has gone deadly silent. After the withdrawal, many commentators and political leaders claimed that there was a humanitarian imperative behind the conflict, particularly the protection of Afghan women. Many of the humanitarian and feminist arguments had been used for years to help justify a military occupation that was often despised by the same people it was ostensibly defending. In contrast, ending the current sanctions regime and releasing funds owned by Afghans actually would do something unambiguously positive for civilians there, including women and children who are particularly at risk. The cognitive dissonance on this place perhaps best underlined by Representative Michael McCall of Texas, the ranking Republican on the House Foreign Affairs Committee. This summer, McCall decried the fate of Afghan women. "We are seeing this nightmare unfold, unmitigated disaster of epic proportions," he said in an interview, adding, "and what I really worry about the most are the women left behind and what's going to happen to them." When the Biden administration then put sanctions exemptions in place to allow some humanitarian aid, McCall then turned around to condemn the limited relief, even as news reports describe the economic collapse wreaking havoc on the lives of Afghans, including women and children. With this new nightmare unfolding, the concern shown in August has largely faded. Sanctions are one of the bluntest coercive tools in U.S. foreign policy toolkit and happen be a favorite of policymakers, even as they rarely produce political results. Afghanistan is just one example of a mindlessly cruel sanctions regime that wreaks havoc on entire civilian populations without accountability. The situation in Afghanistan may yet stand out as one of the deadliest instances of violence against civilians inflicted by U.S. sanctions. The Afghan government that was built over two decades of American occupation was created to be wholly dependent on foreign support, particularly its healthcare system. With the abrupt withdrawal of aid and imposition of sanctions, millions of Afghans, including women and children, are now at risk. More stories of starvation, death from the cold, and families broken apart by economic need are likely to result from the present approach of preventing access to funds owned by the Afghan government and denying aid. And it seems unlikely that such measures will do what 20 years of war could not: build a stable government that keeps the Taliban out of power. Though sanctions on Afghanistan won't achieve U.S. political aims, they are, as in so many other countries, succeeding in visiting cruel consequences upon the most vulnerable. House Democrats have called on Biden to release funds owned by Afghanistan's central bank, but the administration has so far been resistant to do this step. One reason could be that reversing course would reveal the brutality of the underlying policy employing sanctions to deny foreign nations' central banks access to their funds, which the United States government continues to do in other cases. Meanwhile, the broader sanction regime on Afghanistan remains in place, with ordinary Afghans bearing the brunt. To help Afghanistan make progress on the humanitarian front, it is simply not enough to just give aid to Afghanistan. Washington's financial warfare against the country must end, wrote Gregorio Cafiero, CEO of Persian Gulf State Analytics, and an adjunct fellow at the American Security Project, adding, "Those in the West who voice so much concern about the lack of freedom for Afghan women under the Taliban ought to also care about their survival this winter."
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Kazakhstan faces its worst violence experienced since the independence of the Central Asian country in the early 1990s as the Soviet Union collapsed. Dozens of people have died while public buildings across the country have been looted and torched over the past week. It all began with fuel reforms that took effect on January 1, 2022, leading to the doubling of liquefied petroleum gas prices.
Simple events, increasing prices for liquid gas, which most people in Kazakhstan using as a fuel for cars and as a fuel for heating the houses. That was a trigger, that kind of event.
Following that, demonstrations began in the western Manjistau province on Sunday, but then spread across the country and turned violent, resulting in clashes between protesters and security forces. Kazakh President Kasym-Jomart Tokayev's response included accepting the resignation of the government and announcing fixed fuel prices, but also ordering a crackdown. The unrest prompted Tokayev to appeal for help from the Collective Security Treaty Organization to restore peace and security. The Collective Security Treaty Organization is a Russian-led alliance of former Soviet states including Russia, Belarus, Tajikistan, Armenia, Kyrgyzstan, and Kazakhstan. Tokayev blames foreign-trained terrorists for the unrest. He describes a large proportion of the protesters as criminals, saying 20,000 bandits were involved in the unrest in Almaty, Kazakhstan's largest city and the center of the recent unrest. Consequently, he has authorized security forces to open fire without warning in case of further unrest. Initial peaceful protests appear to have been subverted by seemingly well-organized groups of rioters, particularly on Wednesday when the police seemed to leave key installations in the city unprotected. The unrest is seen as an attempt by foreign parties to provoke color revolutions in the ex-Soviet country, modeled on the Rose Revolution in Georgia and the Orange Revolution in Ukraine, which Russia has blamed on the West as an attempt to undermine the security of Kazakhstan.
Obviously, some game of the superpower and Western interference and covert operations always exist.
Russia's top envoy in the U.S., Anatoly Antonov, blames Washington's foreign policy for helping to provoke the crisis in Kazakhstan. Antonov says the root cause of the mayhem is the destabilization in the Middle East and Afghanistan, caused in turn by two decades of U.S. military intervention across Western and Central Asia under the pretext of defending human rights and democracy. Russia says the reason behind its decision to provide military support for Kazakhstan is reaffirming its commitment to allied obligations within the Collective Security Treaty Organization. In addition, Moscow views the recent developments in Kazakhstan as externally provoked attempts at disrupting the security and integrity of the state through violent means, including trained and organized armed groups. Russia also slammed U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken as boorish for saying Kazakhstan would be settled with Russian presence after asking Moscow to send in troops. This came after Blinken told reporters on Friday
that I think one lesson of recent history is that once Russians are in your house, it's sometimes very difficult to get them to leave.
Moscow ramped up the criticism further, also going on to cite a number of Washington's invasions, interventions, and military occupations over the decades, suggesting Blinken might learn a history lesson of his own. It mentioned unfortunate people who had the bad luck to see these uninvited guests at their doorstep, naming Native Americans, Koreans, Vietnamese, and Syrians, among others.
But Russia has much better track record than United States, because United States has about 800 military objects and bases around the globe, and staying unwelcome in a lot of countries.
Russian President Vladimir Putin and his Kazakh counterpart, Kasym-Jomart Tokayev, held a phone conversation to discuss the ongoing unrest in Kazakhstan on Saturday. The two discussed steps to restore order in the country. Tokayev also informed Putin in detail about the situation in the country, noting that it is developing towards a stabilization.
On January 3, 2020, the United States assassinated Iran's Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani alongside the deputy commander of Iraq's Popular Mobilization Unit, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, in a drone strike at the Baghdad airport.
When American democracy is a complete sham, as it was under Trump, and it reached its apotheosis, you could say, with the assassination of a great anti-ISIS fighter, really the main force that was fighting ISIS.
5 days later, Iran launched a barrage of ballistic missiles at Iraq's Ain al-Assad airbase housing U.S. troops in retaliation for the assassination, leaving scores of casualties. The Pentagon downplayed the number of troops injured in the strike, but later admitted that over 100 of its personnel suffered traumatic brain injuries. One died by suicide in October.
See, this, I think this is probably what Pompeo and Trump were counting on. They thought, oh, well, we'll kill this Soleimani, and then maybe Iran will attack us, and that will give us an excuse to go to war against Iran. I'm sure that was their plan, but you didn't do that. That was it's very wise. When you're dealing with an enraged bull, you don't poke it. You go around it, you figure out where its weak spots are, you do that kind of strategizing.
This is what the head of the United States Central Command has told a New Yorker journalist about the airstrike on Ain al-Assad airbase.
They hit pretty much where they wanted to hit. They can strike effectively across the breadth and the depth of the Middle East. They could strike with accuracy and they could strike with volume.
The American general has admitted that Iran's missile capabilities have given the Islamic Republic overmatch, a military term meaning a level of military prowess where the country can overwhelm the enemy by a significant margin. Last August, the Taliban swept to power in Afghanistan in a matter of weeks and seized control of the capital, Kabul, while the U.S. troops were still present in the country. Observers believe the United States' withdrawal from the Central Asian country will go down in history as one of the most chaotic moves Washington has ever made. But a senior commander of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says Americans will have to leave Iraq in a more humiliating manner than the way they left Afghanistan. The commander of the IRGC's Quds Force said the Americans are facing various problems in the region while a resistance front is advancing on a daily basis. Brigadier General Ismail Ghani noted that the resistance fighters are now equipped with missiles and weapons that can target U.S. warships anywhere in the region. The senior commander said Americans will be finally uprooted from the region. He made the remarks at a ceremony in the Iranian city of Mashhad on the second anniversary of the U.S. assassination of Iran's top general Qasem Soleimani and senior Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis.
I don't know. You ask if the U.S. has got the message. Well, sometimes people or nations are so foolish that they go to such a point with their mistaken agenda that it just collapses completely. So that seems to be what's going to happen. I don't know when it will happen, but there seems to be very little possibility of a rational U.S. government.
Despite the United States and its allies' repeated threats, Iran has proven its ability to make good on its promise to mete out a crushing response to any possible aggressor.
Just days into 2022, North Korea carried out a major weapons test. It launched a hypersonic missile this week, with North Korean media saying the projectile precisely hit its target at a distance of 700 kilometers. This was North Korea's second test of a hypersonic missile. Unlike ballistic missiles that fly up into outer space before returning to hit their targets with a somehow predictable trajectory, hypersonic weapons fly at lower altitudes and can achieve more than five times the speed of sound. Analysts say, however, the main feature of hypersonic weapons is not their speed, but their maneuverability makes them much harder to detect by radar. The North is currently part of a small group of countries, including the United States and China, in trying to develop hypersonic military technologies.
They have a plan. They have a plan that is public, there is no secret, is available. And so they have several devices, several weapon range that they want to develop. And one category is the hypersonic one.
The latest test firing came days after North's leader Kim Jong-un pledged once again to boost Pyongyang's defenses. He said in a New Year's speech that Pyongyang would continue to strengthen its capabilities because the Korean Peninsula still faces an increasingly unstable military environment. North Korea tested different projectiles last year amid stalled talks with the United States and its southern neighbor. Under former U.S. President Donald Trump, America and North Korea came close to a conflict before a series of meetings between the two adversaries' presidents. The high-profile summits broke down with no agreement, making Trump's approach towards North Korea another one of his major failures. North Korea has been subjected to Western sanctions for decades. Its relationship with the U.S. and its southern neighbors, South Korea and Japan, both staunch American allies, has been fraught with tensions for a very long time. North Korea is grappling with economic sanctions and chronic food shortages. Pyongyang has suffered under sanctions, but it has somehow managed to withstand the American pressure campaign.
They managed to avoid any trouble to their economy in the same way that many other countries that are under sanctions are doing. So basically they readjust their economy in a way that they can survive.
Despite its long list of economic problems, the North has managed to produce several nuclear warheads, describing them as a necessary insurance against an attack by the U.S. The U.S., which has been calling on North Korea to give up its nuclear weapons, has left no stone unturned to isolate the communist state. But successive U.S. administrations have failed to force North Korea into submission. U.S. President Joe Biden's administration now says it is open to talks, but the North says that's implausible given the record of American hostile policies. The North seems too weary of American ulterior motives. What if it abandons its atomic arms and the U.S. does not drop its hostile policies and keeps up the pressure? This must be one of the key questions that comes to the North Korean leader's mind when he focuses on his country's relationship with America. The North insists that the White House has been determined to take and reluctant to give during past talks. It remains to be seen how Biden will act now to try to ease tensions on the Korean Peninsula.
A new report has warned about the rising threat of extremism in the United States. The report has been prepared by the Atlantic Council's Digital Forensic Research Lab. It says that 12 months after the attack on the Capitol by a pro-Trump mob, far-right groups were traced and arrested by police and federal authorities. But it says other groups have reorganized, often with an emphasis on local-level politics.
it found that domestic extremist groups have recruited and spread their messages through culture war debates, including vaccines, race and education. It says groups such as Proud Boys and QAnon conspiracy movement have re-emerged in recent months. They have made progress by shifting to alternative online platforms, embracing rhetoric to engage more broadly with the mainstream conservative base and engaging in new political activities, particularly public health and education issues at the local level. The report says extremist movements were filled with paranoia following the Capitol riot. It notes that members are suspicious of each other and law enforcement. That has discouraged many members from attending public events.
They morph into different forms and formations, but they tend to follow the same basic tenets, which are white nationalism. So whether we're talking about the Ku Klux Klan or the White Citizens Council or the Oath Keepers, white Southern Baptists or neo-Nazis, the American history is replete with these types of organizations.
These extremist groups have adopted smaller and less sophisticated platforms, and that made them vulnerable to data scrapes, breaches, and hacks. The report warns of the rise of far-wing influencers inside these alternative social media platforms and the dangers that they could bring. Far-right figures like the former top Trump aide Stephen Bannon have encouraged a precinct-by-precinct strategy. It refers to a ground-up approach that focuses on local politics.
In 2022, Ronald Reagan's so-called shining city on the hill has become exposed as a mirage, as the poor, the elderly, and people of color are still fighting in 2022 for one person, one vote.
The report comes as the U.S. prepares to remember the first anniversary of the Capitol Hill riot. During the January 6th riot, thousands of supporters of former President Donald Trump attacked police, vandalized the Capitol, and sent members of Congress and then-Vice President Mike Pence running for their lives. Democrats have been arguing that the riot on January 6th was an insurrection based on disinformation spread by Trump, who alleges that he is the true victor of the 2020 presidential election and not Joe Biden.
As an economic system, based on unbridled capitalism, the system eventually has to implode. The insatiable lust for markets, the insatiable lust for resources and profits cannot be sustained.
A new poll has found that 60% of Americans believe Trump's level of responsibility for the attack was either a great deal or a good amount. Trump is often cited by U.S. media as the one inciting his supporters to storm the Congress premises in the hope of overturning the election results. A committee tasked with investigating the events of the January 6th riot has issued dozens of subpoenas to Trump's current and former associates.
These folks are well-funded, they are very well organized, but I don't think that they are in large enough numbers to where they can really take over the government in the manner in which, you know, in terms of a civil war and that kind of thing. I think that's a bit rhetorical. I think that's a bit of hyperbole.
At least 7 people died in the incident, including a police officer, and more than 700 have been arrested so far for crimes related to the breach.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به حق تعالی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. If you remember, we said that Imam Khomeini strongly criticized the cinematic art of the previous regime as it was one of the main sources of immorality in society, particularly among the young generation. He correctly believed that the dramatic arts, mainly cinema, were the tools of colonial policies of the West and anti-Islamic propaganda of the U.S. and its accomplices in the country. This week, we are going to discuss Imam Khomeini's views on political parties and groups, which were, in fact, the puppets of the big powers in Iran. Stay tuned, please. During the years of a struggle against the despotic Pahlavi regime in Iran, different groups resorted to various methods to topple the ruling system. Mujahideen Khalq Organization, or MKO, was one of those groups which tried to change the political system via armed struggle. The MKO was formed in 1965, with combination of two contradictory ideologies of Islam and Marxism. This organization managed to take a few terrorist acts against the regime, but in 1971, many of its leaders were identified, tortured, or executed by the intelligence apparatus of the regime, called SAVAK. In 1975, some of the MKO ringleaders, through an organizational coup, officially changed the ideology of the group-led to Marxism and committed gruesome murders against their opponents thereafter. Since the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979, there emerged differences of opinion among the MKO leaders and the revolutionary leaders to the extent that, following the dismissal of President Abu'l-Hassan Bani Sadr by the parliament, the MKO started armed activities against the Islamic Republic system and martyred a number of officials and thousands of civilians. After the Iraqi invasion of Iran in 1980, the MKO terrorist outfit transferred its base to Iraq and continued its measures against the Iranian nation. Some of the Western countries tried to put the name of the MKO in the blacklist of terrorist groups to stop its crimes against humanity. But through the pressures of influential regimes, especially the United States, they failed to pursue their demands. The terrorist outfit has been employed by Washington, Tel Aviv, and London as a tool to pursue their nefarious goals against the Iranian nation and the Islamic Republic system. The founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, writes in his testament, "My advice and recommendation to the groups, grouplets, and persons who are active against the nation, the Islamic Republic and Islam, first in addressing their ringleaders inside and outside the country, is that the long experience of taking any measure, designing any plot, and resorting to any country and official should have taught to you who consider yourselves as knowledgeable and wise that the course of a selfless nation cannot be misled by resorting to terror, blast, bomb, and baseless and uncalculated lies. Never can any state and government be toppled through inhumane and illogical methods, especially a nation like Iran, whose young children to its old women and men are sacrificing their lives in the way of the goal, the Islamic Republic, the Quran, and religion. You know, and if you do not, you are thinking very naively that the nation is not with you and the army is not with you. And if you suppose that they have been with you as your friends, your bungling acts and crimes that have occurred through your provocation have separated them from you, and you have failed to do anything except forging enemies." Unquote. Imam Khomeini, addressing terrorist groups, especially the MKO, writes in another part of his testament, "In the end of my life, I benevolently recommend you who have started fighting and countering this afflicted nation, which has saved itself from the oppression of criminals like the Pahlavi regime and the world devourers of the East and the West, through sacrificing their best children and youth. How can the conscience of a human, no matter how wicked it is, to be content for the likely achieving of a position to behave his country and his nation in this way and does not have mercy towards their young and the elderly?" The Imam advises the ringleaders of these grouplets not to be deceived by big powers. He writes, "I advise you to give up such useless and unwise acts and not be gulled by the world devourers. And wherever you are, if you have committed crime, return to your country and the lap of Islam. Repent, as God is the most merciful of the merciful, and the Islamic Republic and the nation will, inshallah, forgive you. And if you have committed a crime that God has determined your decree, still return from halfway and return. Or if you are not brave enough, accept the punishment and hence save yourselves from God's painful punishment. Otherwise, wherever you are, do not waste your life anymore and embark on another job as it is to your benefit." Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, addressing the internal and external advocates of the MKO terrorist grouplet, writes in his testament, "Then I recommend their internal and external advocates. For what motive do you waste your youth? For those whom have been proved to be serving the powerful world devourers and follow their schemes and have been fallen in their traps. In whose way are you wronging your own nation? You are the beguiled of them, and if you are in Iran, you're witnessing that the million-strong masses are loyal to the Islamic Republic and sacrifice for it. And you are witnessing that the current state and regime are wholeheartedly at the service of the destitute. And those who are spuriously feigning popularity, being mujahid and devotees of the people, have embarked on enmity against God's people and have beguiled you simple boys and girls for their purposes and the purposes of one of the world-devouring poles of power. Whereas they are either reveling in the lap of one of the criminal poles or inside the country, they are leading a luxurious life in team houses like the houses of the wretched criminals while sending you youth to death. My kind advice to you teenagers and youth inside and outside is to return from the wrong way and be united with the deprived of the society who are serving the Islamic Republic wholeheartedly. And be active for the independent and free Iran, to that the country and the nation get rid of the evil of the opponents and all continue noble life together. How long and why will you be subordinate to those who do not think except for their vested interest? You are fighting your nation in the lap of the superpowers while they have sacrificed you for their sinister purposes and seeking power.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Snowfall and dropping temperatures have increased the problems of the poor and needy people across Afghanistan. Here, we're visiting some displaced families who face harsh conditions in their camps in Kabul. Bushra Amiri, a mother of 10, is displaced from Helmand province. She says she has nothing to feed her children or heat her simple shack.
I am a widow and have several children. I'm really desperate to feed them and keep them warm. My neighbors used to help us, but now everyone is short of money and food.
Other people in this camp have the same problems. Almost all of them are deprived of their basic needs.
There is no hope for survival. We are left here with no house, no money, and no bread. We are human beings. Why is no one paying attention to us or help us? What should we do in this cold weather and severe snowfall?
These displaced families hope that the charities and the government could help them to survive the winter. Hundreds of men and women from two camps have come here to enlist them for receiving some aid. Bushra Amiri is happy as she receives some aid and food donated by the WFP and the Gulzad Group.
I'm very happy today because I have received some food for my family. My children will have something to eat for next month. We thank charities for their humanitarian aid. However, we need more assistance, including warming clothes and heating.
Afghanistan's financial system has been in a free fall since the Taliban took over, partly due to aid cuts and the freeze of some $10 billion in Afghan assets by the U.S.
In addition to dealing with cold weather, most of these families are unable to buy food and medicines. They say it will be very difficult for them to survive this harsh winter if urgent assistance is not provided. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has delivered a speech on the anniversary of an uprising in the Iranian city of Qom on January 9, 1978, against the toppled U.S.-backed Pahlavi regime. The leader reminded the United States of its miscalculations and wrong policies toward the Iranian nation. He pointed to the visit of then-U.S. President Jimmy Carter to Iran several days before the Qom uprising. In that visit, Carter had described the circumstances of Iran under the Pahlavi regime as an island of stability. But later, Ayatollah Khamenei said Carter had to try to quell more uprisings across Iran to prevent the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution, a goal he failed to achieve. The leader said the U.S. has made more miscalculations regarding Iran. He added an outstanding example is the 2020 assassination of anti-terror icon Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Since the Islamic Revolution, successive U.S. presidents have left no stone unturned to achieve their anti-Iran ambitions through different means, including military threats and imposition of sanctions. In line with that policy, former U.S. President Donald Trump in 2018 withdrew his country from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, known as the JCPOA. That's a deal Iran clinched in 2015. Trump imposed tough sanctions on Iran as part of his so-called maximum pressure campaign, a policy incumbent American officials, including Secretary of State Antony Blinken, have explicitly admitted that has failed. Nonetheless, the current U.S. administration seems to be pursuing the wrong policies of its predecessors toward Iran. One example proving that is the U.S. refusal to remove the anti-Iran sanctions in order to pave the way for reviving the JCPOA that got into trouble because of Washington's withdrawal. Now, it's up to the White House to decide to take a lesson from those wrong policies and reverse course or continue the same anti-Iran agenda.
Britain's highest rank for chivalry, awarded by Queen Elizabeth to former Prime Minister Tony Blair, a man described by campaigners as one of the most repugnant political figures in the world, in power from 1997 to 2007.
The backlash to the announcement has been immense and is only growing. Furious Iraq War veterans are now calling for the honor system to be overhauled. And more than 500,000 people have signed a petition calling on the Queen to strip the man they call a war criminal of his new title.
It's a designation routinely awarded to former prime ministers here, but anti-war campaigners say they're repulsed at seeing Blair receiving it. And they have their reasons.
For millions of people in this country, it's an absolute insult, as it is to the people of Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, and various other places where we've now seen the war on terror over the last 20 years. And I don't see any justification for it whatsoever. I think that Blair never conceded that he was wrong about any of these things. The Chilcot inquiry, which was very, very critical of him, he immediately held a very long press conference afterwards and said he would do exactly the same again.
In mid-February 2003, just before the Iraq invasion, tens of millions of demonstrators in hundreds of cities across the world, including in London, marched against the impending U.S.-led war in the Middle East. To Tony Blair, the biggest protest march in British history was fatuous.
The fact is that had we been listened to and had Britain not taken part in the war almost certainly would not have taken place, that America would have been much less likely to go to war alone. And we would have seen a much different world today, a day where far more people would be alive as a result of that war not happening, would be far fewer refugees.
The U.S. claimed the regime of former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein possessed weapons of mass destruction and actively pressed for invading Iraq in late 2001. The weapons were never found. Two decades on, 1 million Iraqis dead, 3 million dispossessed, and a region reeling from terrorism and instability. Hundreds of British troops were also killed in the same conflict. Anti-war campaigners say Tony Blair belongs in the dock at The Hague, and not in the pantheon of great leaders. Saeed Pourreza, London.
Cleared of criminal damage charges at Bristol Crown Court, Rhiann Graham, Myla Ponsford, Jake Skuse, and Sage Willoughby, dubbed the Colston Four, celebrated their acquittal in a trial that's divided British public opinion. For those who had been on trial, relief and a sense of vindication.
We are ecstatic and stunned. I tried to write something ready for this moment, and I'm just so overwhelmed.
We didn't change history, we rectified
history. We illuminated history. They lied. We illuminated history.
And this is a victory for Bristol. This is a victory for racial equality.
And this is where it began, at a Black Lives Matter demonstration in Bristol in June 2020.
I think the court accepted that this was almost a political show trial, that Boris Johnson and the Home Secretary Priti Patel had determined that they wanted to make an example of the Colston Four, and the courts rejected that.
The jury's verdict has garnered mixed reviews, with some MPs writing to the Attorney General asking him to look once more at the wrong result. Elsewhere, there have been calls for the Home Secretary to explain why this case was so heavily pursued in the first place, and what happens now when that move has seemingly backfired.
The focus is now on high-profile monuments like the statue of Sir Winston Churchill, Britain's lauded World War II leader, but a figure that's being seen increasingly through the lens of his controversial views on race and empire.
New legislation being pushed through under the Police and Crime Bill will make defacing monuments punishable by up to 10 years behind bars.
Women watchers to your station will be surprised to know you can get longer for pulling down a statue under the new provisions than you do for rape, which is absolutely bizarre. But it shows the extent to which this government is intent on pursuing culture wars and criminalising the Black Lives Matter movement.
There is the hope that many local and national stakeholders will use the outcome of the Colston Four trial as a teachable moment, a chance to reflect on Britain's checkered past. But then again, maybe it will just be business as usual. Amina Taylor, London.
Hisham Abu Hawash has been refusing to eat for 141 days. But he's finally breaking his fast because the Israeli regime has agreed to release him next month. Abu Hawash has been receiving a great deal of support from the Palestinian people, who have rallied, protesting his unjust detention and demanding his freedom. And now these people finally have a reason to celebrate. In Al-Khalil, Abu Hawash's home, his supporters have turned out to rejoice this victory against Israeli jailers. His family had an especially tough time in recent days after doctors warned that Abu Hawash's health was deteriorating, that he was slipping in and out of coma and facing the danger of sudden death. Now they can finally breathe a sigh of relief.
I thank all the Palestinians who stood with us. Thanks to everyone who helped my brother. I thank God they released him.
During the past 3 days, we lived through a psychological war that was carried out by the Israeli intelligence due to what was happening with my brother Hisham. There were strong maneuvers, but we overpassed those as a family. Today, Hisham achieved victory for all the Palestinians.
Now, Abu Hawash's lawyer says he would be hospitalized for medical follow-up before his designated release on February 26. Palestinian officials have weighed in, praising his resistance.
Hisham Abu Hawash prevails after 141 days of hunger strike.
We hail Hisham for his forceful will, his family, Palestinian people, and people around the world who raise their voices in solidarity. Thank